Welcome to the Tech Policy Podcast. I'm Evan Schwartzstrauber. On today's show, fake news and the fairness doctrine. The election of Donald Trump has got a lot of people in a tizzy, especially those who've seen fake news proliferate on Facebook, many arguing that fake news helped swing the election to Donald Trump. But let's start with the fairness doctrine, because the president-elect has started a new debate about an old policy in a tweet that he sent. Quote, I watched parts of Saturday Night Live last night. It is a totally one-sided, biased show. Nothing funny at all, he wrote. And then he added, quote, equal time for us, question mark. What is the president-elect talking about? Well, of course, many are looking at the fairness doctrine, and it seems like that's a direct reference to that old policy. So joining me to discuss this is a lawyer who knows things about the fairness doctrine, prodigal son returning, and president of Tech Freedom, Baron Soka. Baron, welcome back to the United States.
I wish I could say I was happy to be back.
You escaped. You were not in the United States during the election.
No, I went as far as I possibly could back in time to Petra, Jordan, which is a superb site if you're into archaeology, and exactly the right time zone to miss the entire election evening. You go to bed before the polls have closed. You wake up and the whole thing's over. Best way to do it.
So if you're ever down about a unusually negative election with two unpopular candidates, Baron Soka recommends that you go to Petra. So there you go, because that way you can go to sleep and wake up and the whole thing's over. But Baron, let's start with the fairness doctrine before getting to the obviously huge topic of fake news on Facebook. Remind our listeners, I don't think we've actually ever talked about this on the show, what is the fairness doctrine?
So I want to say at the outset, this is related to the fake news subject. It's related to net neutrality. It's related to much of discussion about the media. This is the lens through which people have looked at media and media bias and the idea that people might be, in a sense, rigging elections or exerting undue influence for decades. So back in 1948, the Truman administration authorized the creation of the third networks, right? So we talk about the big three. Well, for a while, they were the big two. And the Truman administration.
NBC and CBS, right?
The Truman administration allowed the creation of the third network. I actually think NBC was the third. I don't remember which came
ABC,
in which order. It doesn't matter. But the point was that so there were three networks created. And then they essentially closed the door. They pulled up the drawbridge, built a wall, and they didn't let any other broadcasters in. And so that was the strategy going forward. And part of that was that they didn't grant more licenses. But part of it also was that they used this idea, the fairness doctrine, to essentially stop new competition and new forms of discourse. So they protected the model of the big three, the format of the shows, by requiring that if you talked about a controversial topic, you had to give equal side to the other, to the equal time to the other side. And that effectively prohibited the rise of what in the 1980s became talk radio, which was that, Rush Limbaugh hated the media establishment. So he could have his own show on a radio station and he could talk about things. And he didn't, by virtue of bringing up, abortion or contraception policy, he didn't have to have Jocelyn Elders on the show in the Clinton administration. So this is a way of saying that for decades, the right was obsessed with this issue, and for very good reason, because I actually have a quote handy that I think really helps to make this point clear. A Kennedy advisor came along and admitted, see, because in the Eisenhower administration, there were a lot more licenses granted. So all of a sudden, there were these right-wing people out there on the radio that had not been given licenses before. And the Kennedy administration came in and they seized upon the amplified enforcement of the fairness doctrine, which was started in 1948. And this Kennedy advisor later admitted, quote, our massive strategy was to use the fairness doctrine to challenge and harass right-wing broadcasters and hope that the challenges would be so costly to them that they would be inhibited and decide it was too expensive to continue. So that essentially was what some people have called architectural censorship.
But so was this really a problem for conservatives? I mean, if the whole point of the fairness doctrine was equal time for equal views, then in theory, from 1949 until 1987, when the fairness doctrine was in effect, you had a conservative or a Republican voice, and you had a lefty or a Democrat voice, and they would debate, and the news anchor would moderate, and then you would get both sides of the story. I mean, why is that an issue for conservatives?
Yeah, yeah. In theory. And in practice, that's not really what happens. So there are, you can think about the places where that did happen. So William F. Buckley's firing line on PBS is essentially what people have in mind as how the Fairness Doctrine was supposed to operate in practice. But really, that happened because William F. Buckley was committed to intellectual debate, and he wanted to have both sides on, and they would be thoughtful people who would talk about an issue in detail. What actually happened in the rest of the media is that the media essentially avoided difficult topics because it wasn't just that you had to have somebody on from the other side. You then exposed yourself to legal challenge. You could potentially lose your broadcast license because the government decided that you didn't really give equal time, or the person that you had on really wasn't a fair representative of the other side.
How do you even enforce these things?
Exactly. And so that's the fundamental question. So effectively what it did, and that quote that I just read you from that Kennedy advisor makes very clear that what was equal time in theory was really about stultifying dissent in practice. So it's a little bit like, you know, before Brown versus Board of Education, in principle, we had separate but equal. But in practice, black schools were terrible, right? Sort of a similar thing here where in theory, you have equal time separation of views. But in practice, you avoided difficult topics and you got sort of a mushy consensus presentation that effectively was left of center, because that's the entire media was left of center.
Right. I mean, journalists will often self-report overwhelmingly Democratic or left-leaning political sensibilities. Obviously, you know, that's just the way it is. There are certain professions that lend themselves to certain ideologies, because if you're, you know, government accountability watchdog, that kind of lends itself maybe to a lefty, anti-corporate, anti-establishment sensibility. But yeah, if you ask people like my dad, he'll say that the three news anchors were all leftists. And there was no way of, you could not convince a conservative that Walter Cronkite and Dan Rather were presenting a fair slate. So they looked to things like talk radio or alternative media, maybe the Wall Street Journal editorial board. I mean, we're talking way before the internet. So it's not like very easy to go out and get these differing viewpoints. So you talk to those people and they say, oh yeah, the Fairness Doctrine was essentially liberals only get to speak.
Yeah, because the way to think about it is what it ended up meaning was that, yeah, maybe Dan Rather didn't have Ralph Nader on, because if he had Ralph Nader on, he'd have to have a conservative on to respond. So he just presented views that were sort of close to Ralph Nader's as the news. And so that was a kind of orthodoxy in the mainstream media that conservatives rightly rebelled against, which is why, and you mentioned this already, the Reagan administration repealed the Fairness Doctrine at the FCC. And so that allowed the flourishing of independent talk radio, of frankly, I think, much healthier discourse. It wasn't perfect in many ways. You can critique the new media all you want, but you had Fox News. You had other things that came out. And then on the left, you had responses to that. You had MSNBC. And then the internet came along and it just continued that trend. And we can have a discussion now about how we deal with that and whether there are filters, whether people are seeing too much of people that agree with them. But fundamentally, we should all be able to agree that it's a good thing that the government got out of the business of deciding whether media was fair or not. And in the last few years, you've seen conservatives so fixated on the evils of the Fairness Doctrine that the net neutrality fight, which is sort of on some level, sort of kind of a little bit like the Fairness Doctrine, was again and again described as being the Fairness Doctrine for the internet, as if there were no differences. And so with that in mind, it's just nothing less of shocking that the new Republican president, the first thing he says about media in office is essentially, we should bring back the Fairness Doctrine because he doesn't like being ridiculed on Saturday Night Live.
So let's talk about problems with bringing back the Fairness Doctrine from both sides. And there's a lot of pushback, and there was a lot of talk about bringing it back because, frankly, people like Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity succeeded and make tens of millions of dollars a year, and Air America, the left's attempt at talk radio, failed. I mean, so from a very cynical standpoint, you look at the calls from the left to bring back the Fairness Doctrine throughout the 80s and 90s, and it's because they couldn't master the new medium of talk radio. They just didn't do it as well. So therefore, they wanted people like Rush Limbaugh, who do a 3-hour show, to somehow figure out how to give an hour and a half to someone else. It wouldn't have worked. But you've gotten pushback from both sides. So it was discontinued in 1987, officially erased from the books in 2011, which was something that conservatives have been asking for because they didn't trust the government.
Which in turn kept this issue alive and prompted a big debate about it back then.
Yeah, so you've got pushback now from both sides. You've got Democrat FCC commissioner, or former chairman, Julius Genachowski, saying that it could just chill free speech, right? The basic argument that you bring this back, it chills free speech. That's a Democrat. On the right, you've got talk radio basically saying this would just do away with talk radio. It cannot exist in its current form. So you've got reasons on both sides. And it seems like whoever is the butt of the criticism, whoever's getting the crap, wants to get rid of or wants to bring back the fairness doctrine. So here we go. We're right after the election of Donald Trump. People are obviously still very shocked, opinionated about this, saying a lot of things. And Saturday Night Live, what they do is they mock elected officials. And you could argue all day that the writers are probably lefties, so they criticize Republicans more. I mean, whatever you want to say. But this part about equal time, even if the Fairness Doctrine were on the books, Alec Baldwin pointed out that equal time is only for candidates, not for elected officials. So, I mean, what's the problem here?
Right. Well, so we're now getting into the weeds of how the Fairness Doctrine was actually supposed to work, but we're quibbling about this. I mean, the idea of bringing this back is just nutty. And we wouldn't be talking about this except for the president's tweet.
Right. And that's an interesting commentary on the state of media, that a tweet can then bring back a debate about something that has only applied to legacy media, has never been applied to the internet.
Yeah. And I should make clear, the Fairness Doctrine was a responsibility imposed on broadcast licensees. The Fairness Doctrine was never applied to cable, for example. It was never applied in new media. So, this is maybe a good way to pivot to this discussion about fake news. We now seem to be in this conversation where people on the left are joining with some people, at least in the past on the right, maybe this summer, like in the when it was alleged that Facebook was censoring conservatives.
Right.
There are people on both sides of the aisle who seem to be saying that there's something wrong with our national discourse, with new media, with the way the internet works, and shaking their fists and saying there ought to be a law. And when they talk about that, whether they're talking about fake news or the censorship of people that they like, they're effectively hearkening back to the Fairness Doctrine, whether they're evoking it or not. And the specific remedy may not be exactly the same, but it is the same basic idea that it is the government's job to level the playing field and ensure fair discourse. In other words, it is the idea that the First Amendment is some kind of a sword by which the government should ensure the fairness of media rather than a shield against the government intruding in media at all. And that idea is a profoundly, ultimately Marxist idea that comes out of a media access theorist professor in the 1960s called Jerome Barron. And it's just ironic now that you see people across the political spectrum latching onto that idea and not understanding that it is totally antithetical to media freedom.
So there might be some people who, when they talk about fake news, they are talking about the Fairness Doctrine. But let's start with the company first, because I think most of the outrage has been directed at Facebook and most of the suggestions that something be done have been directed at the company. So how do we get to this point where fake news is such a hot topic and people are making arguments that Facebook might have swung the election for Trump? You had a couple of famous fake stories on Facebook that really got out there. One was that Donald Trump was endorsed by Pope Francis. It was shared millions of times. It was obviously false. Another one that was...
Especially given that Trump attacked the Pope.
Well, right. But let's... Yeah, obviously. But then there was another one. You can find fake news that might benefit Hillary Clinton. It was a photo of Donald Trump from the 90s. With a fake quote from People News where he said, if I ever ran for president, I would do it as a Republican because those voters are idiots. You can tell them anything, et cetera, et cetera. And clearly it was written by someone who thought that that was the dynamic that was occurring in the Republican primary, decided that Donald Trump was being a con man and things that a lot of Republicans accused him of, and wrote that quote essentially trying to make it seem like in 1998, Donald Trump had crafted his master plan to con the American public into nominating him. So point being, there are millions of shares and likes on both sides. And while Facebook and Google do both ban fake news from their advertising platforms, as we've seen, something fake can still rise to prominence by getting a lot of likes or a lot of shares. And a former Facebook designer, Bobby Goodlatte, wrote on November 8th on his own Facebook wall, quote, "Sadly, newsfeed optimizes for engagement. As we've learned in this election, bullshit is highly engaging. So, Barron, what responsibility do platforms like Facebook or Google have to prevent fake news, fake information from proliferating on their sites, which are used by over a billion people each?
Well, the best response I saw about this was Mark Zuckerberg, dead at 36, insists that Facebook has no fake news problem.
Yeah.
I think we can probably all agree that Mark did not handle this issue well by simply dismissing these concerns.
Yeah, so let's start. He said 99% of all the information on Facebook is legitimate. Only a small sliver is fake. And then he said it would be almost, he basically dismissed the idea that fake news could swing the election. I mean, do you think that was too flippant?
Yeah, I think it is too flippant. And we've seen Facebook's own engineers, some of them have come out and very loudly insisted that Facebook does have a problem and they need to figure out how to engineer for it. But let me say what I think we said on the show we did this summer about the controversy about Facebook supposedly suppressing conservative views. We should put that in the show notes, and I would encourage people to go back and listen to it. There is a big difference between the two of us having a conversation about how Facebook should handle these things. And whether they should improve moderation to make it more neutral and try to hire people who are not all from one side of the political spectrum to do moderation, right? In that case, and then here, there are things that Facebook could do. Maybe having a button that says this is a fake story would be
which
a great,
they now have,
right?
Yeah.
So that seems like a good way to deal with the problem. And maybe that will effectively be a solution. Maybe there are the things that should be done. We should have that conversation. Where I have a problem, though, is where that conversation bleeds into, and the government should do something, and your senator should send a letter, or the president should get involved here. That is what I was comparing to the Fairness Doctrine. That's a form of having the government meddle, right? Versus just like my reference to that William F. Buckley show, Firing Line. That was, you know, one guy decided to run a show in the way that he thought the Fairness Doctrine ought to work, right? And that's fine. If that's what you want to do on one show, what I'm concerned about is that it's very hard for people to draw a line here and distinguish between us having a conversation about how to do better ethical reporting and discussion online and even just an ethical conversation about what duty, if you post something that you didn't know was fake and that someone points out was fake, what duty do you have to go back and amend your post? I mean, that's a sort of etiquette question.
Yeah, that's an individual right? question. So let's also, I just want to recap people on this whole trending topics issue because the two issues are directly related and there's a really interesting comparison there. So a while back, and we recorded a show on this, we'll link to it in the show notes, Facebook came under fire because former employees told Gizmodo, a tech publication, that Facebook had routinely suppressed conservative news in its trending topics section. So now, listeners, I'm differentiating here. Trending topics, it's in the top right corner of your Facebook page. If you're using it on desktop, it's much more similar to Twitter. It shows stories that are trending. This is news. It's not the news feed. And the accusation was that because Facebook is full of lefty employees, they would just, humans would editorialize against these stories and not include them. Big kerfuffle ensues. Letter from a senator gets sent to Facebook. So that's the kind of soft power you see from government where we're not talking about a regulation, but it did obviously ruffle their feathers and cause them to get worried. So Facebook decided to remove humans from the equation. So now only things that are picked up by the algorithm will be put in trending news. And then what happened, right? Before, Facebook had made sure that things like Black Lives Matter and police shootings would be included in trending topics. They would editorialize that certain things were important and worth hearing. Conservatives get all up in arms, accuse Facebook of being a conspiracy against conservatives. We criticize them for overreacting. And then what happens? Facebook removes humans, and now you've got fake news popping up on trending topics. So
because the algorithm can be manipulated.
Yeah, and here's the really perverse incentive. Every time people ask Facebook to do something, to automate something, to remove humans from the equation, all it does is make it a dumber platform because now fake stuff can proliferate. But now you're telling them to put humans back into the equation to make sure that conservative fake news doesn't pop up in people's news feeds. So you can't have it both ways. And as Ryan Hageman, a colleague of ours, put in a Hill op-ed, damned if you do, damned if you don't. right? I mean, if you want it to be automated, fake stuff's going to get in there. If you want it to be humans, then it's not going to necessarily be fake, but then they'll get accused of political bias. So if you're Facebook, what you're in a catch-22, what the hell are you supposed to do?
So my concern is that where this ultimately goes is the same place that in the debate about search neutrality a few years ago, law professor named Frank Pasquale suggested, yeah, we ought to have a federal search commission. We'll just have a team of noble government bureaucrats that are responsible for going in and making sure that things are fair under the hood. And you can very easily see how ultimately the same idea could be applied here, where maybe it's not a new commission, maybe it's the FCC, maybe it's the Federal Trade Commission, maybe it doesn't happen formally through legislation, maybe it just happens through an ongoing series of nasty letters from the Hill, that you get the government intruding on decisions about who's getting hired to do these screening roles. How does the algorithm work? Could you show us the algorithm? Could you please come in and walk us through this? And then all of a sudden, we wind up in a situation where there's no wall between the government and private enterprise anymore. And then Facebook essentially becomes a tool of government. And now maybe in the United States, maybe that wouldn't be the worst thing in the world. Maybe there's enough respect for the First Amendment that doesn't lead to abuse. But if we start setting up that system here, that will be used, the carbon copy of that will be used for outright direction from the government to platforms of what content should be.
Yeah, and then a massive difficulty here, even if you're not talking about the government, or maybe you are. I mean, whoever is responsible for designing an AI that somehow can fix this problem, a bunch of college students tried to do this, right? And there were some headlines like college students solve fake news problem. Not exactly. They created some type of algorithm that would try to verify facts, but they ran into a major difficulty, and they described it this way, quote, building an AI that knows the difference between a fact and an opinion so that we do not flag opinions as false, since only facts can be false. So that's another huge problem, is that Mark Zuckerberg pointed out there are people who flag things on Facebook as false or misleading when it's just something they don't like or it's something they just disagree with, and it's an opinion piece. And there's a ton of op-eds that get shared on Facebook that are very sensationalist, that have clickbaity headlines, and it could be easy to mistake an opinion you don't agree with fake news. And well, you're trying to put that in the company's hands. You're trying to put that in the government's hands. I mean, good luck.
So this essentially is exactly the same issue that we talk about a lot on the show about Section 230. We've talked about that in the Airbnb context recently. The reason that Congress granted back in 1996 an immunity to platforms for the speech of their users is that they understood that what we're describing here, what you just summarized, Evan, is essentially a judicial function. And it's something that courts have struggled with for decades. We have an elaborate body of First Amendment law that is developed to balance those interests and to figure out when is something defamatory? When is it really not true? When is it an opinion? How do we weigh that balancing? That is very difficult. If you start delegating that task to private entities, and this is to return to the fairness doctrine, you then have this situation where in principle, in theory, you're ensuring fairness and you're punishing the dissemination of false stories, and you're protecting the health of our democracy. But in practice, what you end up doing is stifling certain points of view, making media mushy and more anodyne overall. In other words, that approach to dealing with fake news could actually end up looking a lot like the end result of the fairness doctrine. Even though the mechanism isn't going to be equal time, the mechanism is, well, you write this algorithm that screens out certain content and maybe certain sources, and or you have human beings do it, but then the human beings are biased and maybe the government gets involved in the hiring. I just don't think this is something the government should be doing at all. We should ultimately rely on a marketplace of ideas where Facebook tries to strike a balance and Twitter strikes a balance in a different way. And some new platform that's coming around the corner has an entirely different approach. And this evolves over time, and the government basically butts out. And so the president doesn't end up driving the decisions that Facebook makes as it continues to iterate. That ultimately is the only way to go forward on this.
Yeah, and of course, Facebook is concerned because you've got people like President Obama calling out fake news and Time Magazine, very high profile. You've got our good buddy Tim Lee at Vox writing how Facebook is harming our democracy. Mark Zuckerberg insisting we are a tech company, not a media company. Many people saying that that's crap and that when you have a billion users and 60% of them are getting at least some of their news from the platform, that you can't keep hiding behind this whole tech company thing. What do you think about that? The idea that because Facebook and Google are so important for the way that we consume all types of content and that while we might be posting baby pictures to Facebook, we're also getting our news from there. Do these companies now have a new responsibility beyond your standard tech company protected by Section 230? Do you think they have a new responsibility to tackle these problems?
I think it is important for them, for their own financial stake, for the health of the platform, before we even get to the health of our democracy, to think hard about this and to think harder about it than Mark's somewhat offhanded dismissal would seem to suggest. Because there clearly are people in Facebook who have been working very hard on this. The news stories that came out about this actually indicate that they self-organized within the company and they formed a sort of task force. And they're dealing with the problem. And the company is figuring out how to do this. And it's, as everything, as with everything in the tech world, they're iterating as they go. And so I think that process is not, it's never going to be perfect. And I'm not saying that they're done and they should declare victory and move on. It's always going to be a moving target. But I do think there's a difference between that and elevating this to the level of where the president of the United States harasses Mark Zuckerberg or Google executives on Twitter and shakes his fist at them. And the example that I would leave you with here that I find very disturbing is, let's rewind to WikiLeaks. When the initial revelations broke, the US government brought pressure to bear on WikiLeaks through a number of means. And one of them was that Joe Lieberman, who at the time was chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, was able to get Amazon to shut off hosting to WikiLeaks just by through a single angry phone call. So if that kind of thing happens where a government official with no legal authority, no process, no nothing, can either in private or in public exert that kind of pressure on a tech company to change what they're doing, to shut off a particular site that they don't like, or to change the hiring practices, or you know, bring someone in new, or rewrite their algorithm, or redesign their interface. That it's not hard to see how that becomes a tool for the government to exert undue influence on media. And that really ought to disturb everybody from left to right. And to people on the right, I would just remind them of their concern about the Fairness Doctrine for decades. And what would happen if someone, you know, if another, quote, dictator, unquote, like Barack Obama got into office? I mean, remember everything that people on the right said about the president, this president's abuses of his power. Just think what the next Democrat could do to you if President Trump started making a regular habit of using his Twitter account to browbeat, or a jawbone is the technical term that lawyers use to describe this process, tech companies into doing his bidding. And the same is true on the left. You don't want to see this administration gain that kind of power.
Yeah, of course. And there are ways of reacting to this, right? You can say, oh, Facebook, such a problem, right? Fake news is a huge problem. Facebook has to solve it. But you could also say, what does this say about ourselves, right? What does this say about the man in the mirror? And you can look at Pew Research to see how Americans are using social media. Right. So if the premise is that fake news is a problem because people use social media so much and they rely on it so much, well, let's see if that's actually the case, rather than making grand claims, as Tim Lee did in his op-ed, that Facebook is harming our democracy. And I didn't see a lot of data to back that up. But Pew finds, look, 7 in 10 Americans say they hardly ever or never use Facebook to comment, discuss, or post about politics. 7 in 10. Right. So those people you would think of as your baby and wedding photos, right? The main reasons for Facebook. Half of them say that there is a mix of political views in the network, right? So this idea that we're all in a filter bubble, only 20% of people really fit into that filter bubble category. And Pew found that people who create the bubble are the most politically active, right? So the people who are least likely to change their minds, they're Republican all the way, Democrat all the way, they're really dug in. Those are the people creating the bubble, not necessarily your apathetic, ambivalent, or your swing voter. So a lot of things to consider, and I'd encourage people to look at this research. We'll link to it in the show notes, but it really does give an interesting look into how Americans use Facebook and other social media, and you'd be hard-pressed to conclude from that that it could swing an election. I mean, it certainly is influential, but to suggest that Facebook is determining who becomes president, the data do not support that.
Well, if we get in on a prediction, I'm going to go out on a limb and predict that your call for greater focus on data and looking in at ourselves and asking ourselves whether maybe we bear some responsibility for the ills of the world, I'm going to bet that both of those predictions end up going nowhere anytime soon, and that we see less and less focus on data and more willingness to blame big companies, the other side, the last president, the opposition, whoever, instead of actually thinking through our own decisions.
Well, another thing, as we've discussed, I mean, the online environment, your Facebook profile, your Twitter profile is partly a reflection of yourself, right? And who you associate with and the views that you have. So if you don't have a lot of friends with different political views, if you don't have diversity in your friend group, that will be reflected in Facebook. And if you are, you do have a lot of diverse friends and viewpoints and you're exposed to that, then that will also be reflected in Facebook. So it really is a personal responsibility thing. I know you hate to hear it, folks, but this is kind of on you to do a better job of curating your Facebook page. It requires you to go out and like things that you don't actually like, but you want to see their views. So I'll leave you with this quote from Frank Bruni in the New York Times about the mirror effect. Quote, "When it comes to elevating one perspective above all others and herding people into culturally and ideologically inflexible tribes, nothing that Facebook does to us comes close to what we do to ourselves," end quote. So, Baron, any final thoughts on fake news and the fairness doctrine before we sign off?
Well, as somebody who has a very, very politically diverse array of friends, most of whom do not agree with me, I will just say that it's a lot of work trying to keep up with them and especially keep it civil when people disagree. And that fundamentally the reason that people do self-segregate and self-sort ideologically is that it's the path of least resistance. And as Homer Simpson, you know, famously said, things that are hard aren't worth doing.
Well, there you go. And of course, if you're going to keep clicking on clickbait, then there will be more clickbait. That is just how that works. So stop clicking on clickbait and maybe you'll see a change. But that's it for today's show. My guest has been Prodigal Son Returning and President of Tech Freedom, Baron Soka, who very intelligently escaped the election by flying all the way to Israel and Jordan. So Baron, well done. Thanks for your epic return appearance that people have been awaiting. Just they can't contain their excitement. They finally got your perspective.
Oh, we have several more fascinating shows coming up on topics that will, I'm sure, rivet the entire audience. Well, not including Uber, vaping, or Airbnb necessarily.
Well, find us on Facebook and Twitter. We do have real pages there discussing real things that actually happened. So that's kind of cool. So check them out. And of course, send us an email at media@techfreedom.org where you can always pitch ideas and topics and let us know how much you enjoy listening to Baron speak.
Or if you want to have equal time on the show, we might or might not invite you on.
Yeah, we're not actually regulated by any such law, but you know, me being a good sport, I'm happy to provide equal time.
And I do actually, I just want to close on this. You know, we run a lot of events, and if you just listen to the podcast, you may not know that, but we have made an effort in every single event that we've ever done to have people from the other side. We do not believe that just sitting around patting yourselves on the back and agreeing with each other is constructive. So,
yes.
I will say that in the next 4 or 8 years, there are going to be things where we end up agreeing with the administration, and there are things where we don't, and we're going to continue to find strange bedfellows across the political spectrum on all of those issues. And the one thing that I will say that we will do again and again is to try to reach out and actually listen to people that may not agree with us to make sure we understand why they think the way they do on a particular issue before we make up our minds.
Yeah, I'd especially enjoy having guests on to respond to episodes we've done if you disagree with the perspective. So I will definitely make a concerted effort as part of our discussion of fake news to get a more diverse perspective on the show. Of course, if you do like the show, that means you should go to the iTunes store and leave us a review because it will help others find it, maybe even people who don't share our views, and that would be nice. Well, that's it for today. Thanks for listening.
Policy Podcast is produced and distributed by Tech Freedom, a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. To learn more about our work, make a tax-deductible donation, or find other episodes, find us online at techfreedom.org.